Woe to you that call evil good and good evil, warned Isaiah. Yet are we really sure, asked Wyoming Catholic College senior Marianne Spies, that Christians understand good correctly? This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. One of the highlights of the academic year here at Wyoming Catholic College is Senior Oration Week. During the fall semester, each senior prepares a thesis, a major research paper on a topic of his or her choosing. Then early in the spring semester, each senior presents the thesis as a half-hour oration, and then fields questions from the audience for a half hour. Questions first from a faculty panel that does the grading, and then from the rest of the audience of students. Last week was Oration Week 2012, and our seniors did not disappoint. Listening to lecture after lecture was a pleasure for our faculty, for our students, for our staff, for our neighbors here in Lander, and for parents and alumni who made the trip to Lander for the week. Miss Marianne Spies used her thesis and oration to explore a question that had been on her mind throughout her 4 years at Wyoming Catholic College. Her title was, Ancient Goodness. Does God hate it, tolerate it, or demand it? Nietzsche and Lewis on good, evil, and spirited Christianity. I asked Marianne how she became interested in that topic.
Well, before coming to WCC, I had gone to another university, and there we had taken a philosophy class that included some writings of Nietzsche. And I'd been so taken by them, and frankly so convinced by the arguments that I was worried I was going to lose my faith. And so I knew at some point I was going to have to look at him more deeply and figure out, okay, why do I disagree with him? Why am I still a Christian even after reading his writings and reading his arguments like that?
Now, what apparent conflicts did you see between the morality of Christianity and that of the ancients? I know you quoted some Bible verses in your oration.
Yeah, I began my oration by quoting certain Bible verses. I quoted, blessed are the poor in spirit, and then posed the question, well, why not blessed are the great in spirit? And then I also quoted, love your enemies. Well, why can't you hate your enemies like the ancient heroes that are always fighting their enemies, and that's part of their glory? Why can't that be part of Christianity? Or why do we say in Christianity, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, when we have this tendency, especially as liberal arts students, to wish to be great like these ancient heroes? We want to be exalted? And so I was essentially asking the question in my thesis iteration, is there a place for this desire for greatness in Christianity?
The greatness of who? Achilles?
Yeah, Odysseus? So the greatness embodied by Achilles or embodied by the ancient Roman heroes, like you think Mucius, Scaevola, sort of this desire for something greater than just an ordinary human life, the desire for, frankly, godlikeness.
Mm-hmm. Well, regarding Christianity, Nietzsche, who was a fan of ancient goodness and ancient spiritedness, said, quote, morality is, the mediocre are worth more than the exceptions. I abhor Christianity with a deadly hatred, close quote. Tell us about Nietzsche and about his critique of Christian morality.
Okay. So Nietzsche, interestingly enough, grew up in a very Christian home. He was surrounded by what he calls the most sublime examples of submissiveness growing up. And it seemed that the Christians he grew up around had an idea of Christian goodness which was very submissive, very emotionally sensitive, and did not include any of the ancient pagan spirited goodness. And so Nietzsche, when he was then exposed to this idea of the pagan spirited goodness by reading the classics, it was at that point that he then sort of repudiated Christianity and said, well, I find something better in the ancient spiritedness than this Christian weak goodness. So that's what I'm going to pursue in my life, and I'm going to try to destroy this weak idea of Christian goodness, because it's draining Europe of any sort of thumotic spirit that it used to have, any sort of vestiges of the ancient desire for greatness.
And thumotic spirit, what do you mean by that?
By that, well, thumos is an interesting word. In Greek, it means like the heart. I decided to use the word spiritedness in my thesis iteration instead of thumos, particularly because I think spiritedness is a little bit easier to comprehend. It's sort of this this desire for greatness, this desire for glory and courage. C.S. Lewis calls it the chest.
Now, let's move over to C.S. Lewis then. You put C.S. Lewis over against Nietzsche. First, why Lewis? And not, I don't know, Alistair MacIntyre or St. John Paul II, or why Lewis?
Mm-hmm. I'd been struck by the fact that Lewis seemed to include an idea of the spirit of goodness just very directly in his examples of goodness that he was writing about. Like, you think the most obvious example would be Aslan. He's tame, or he's not a tame lion. He's very spirited. He's wild, but he's still good. And so when I realized, wait a minute, this seems to be exactly contra Nietzsche, I decided to see what it was like putting the two of them together. And they ended up being excellent sparring partners. It was interesting how both of them lost their faith as young men. And while Nietzsche then never came back, Lewis did. But then also, when he did, he brought back this idea of spirited goodness and was able to connect it with Christianity in a way that made sense.
And how does he do that in his writings? Or you mentioned already Abolition of Man, of Men Without Chests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he definitely brings it up in Men Without Chests, which it's interesting to read The Abolition of Man after reading Nietzsche. And he does directly mention Nietzsche in there. And then if you read it, you see, just point by point, he seems to be refuting different Nietzschean ideas through The Abolition of Man. That's just an interesting thing to do. I was actually most taken, like, I read a lot of Lewis over the last summer preparing for this, but I was taken with his literary examples, actually, just the ways that he decides to sort of define goodness in his characters. And so I was finding that, like I mentioned Aslan, that he's deciding to show something that's good, but that is very, very spirited and very, very strong. Not sort of this weak Nietzschean good. He has other examples of that in his Space trilogy very, very, very strongly. You have the encounter with the angel at the beginning of Paralandra. He has one of the most interesting descriptions of good there as something that is very, very uncomfortable because it's so powerful. And that's not something that we find in the Nietzschean understanding of Christian good. Mm-hmm. Yes, his examples there, and then these examples are backed up by his more scholarly writings.
Well, Walking the Dog, I've been listening to The Great Divorce, which I've read numerous times, and is probably, it may be my favorite Lewis book. And there, it's those who are just out of hell that are the weak and the wimpy and the whiny. Mm-hmm. And once people get into heaven, they're larger than life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another great example of that. Yeah, it permeates Lewis's writings. It's really neat.
And you mentioned the conversation that the Pevensey children have with the beavers about, well, he's a lion. Well, is he safe?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, I know so many people who've been taken with that conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, no, he's not. Who says anything about safe? He's not safe. Of course not. But he's good. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most striking images you had in your oration, I thought, was the reference to the old mathematics satire, I guess, Flatland. Tell us about that.
Right. So as I was looking at Nietzsche and Lewis and trying to figure out, okay, how exactly do they differ? How does Lewis take the spirited ancient goodness and relate it to Christianity? I kept thinking of this analogy, and so I don't know if you're familiar with the satire Flatland, but in it there are these two-dimensional characters, and so this book sort of shows.
Well, he has a two-dimensional world.
And the
shapes can only see, I mean, I guess there's sort of a little teeny, teeny third dimension, so you can see one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the mathematical satire Flatland sort of presents a world of two dimensions. So you can see to the right, to the left, but there's no up. There's no sense of up. And so as I was reading Lewis and trying to see, okay, how does he take the ancient spiritedness and connect it with Christianity, I kept thinking of this analogy. Like, if we think of natural human life as a two-dimensional plane where you're bounded by space and time, and you might have a sense that there's kind of this up, that there's this godlikeness that a human might be able to attain in some way, or immortality, something like that. But it seems like if this two-dimensional world is an analogy for the natural human world, then the coming of Christ is like taking the top off, and all of a sudden now there's an up. Now humans can actually achieve godlikeness. They can achieve the sort of the the glory and the undying glory that the ancient heroes desired so much.
So how do we close the gap between blessed are the poor in spirit and being spirited in Lewis's sense? And, you know, and I was thinking, I was reading this morning in Galatians, Paul talks about how he was converted and then I went to Arabia and then I went to, he was certainly spirited. He was no Achilles, but, you know, he wasn't a warrior, but he was, he had rather a lot of thumos. Mm-hmm. How do we close that gap?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we have to use this analogy of the dimensions. At least this has been the easiest way I've thought of it. If we say blessed are the poor in spirit, it does seem like that means we're talking on the human realm. Blessed are those who are not so attached to the earth that they can't realize that they have this three-dimensional, so to speak, spiritual space to work within that sort of opened up with Christianity. And so blessed are the poor in spirit because then they can realize that there's this extra space. Or love your enemies. Well, in my thesis, I talked a lot about how Lewis, he bases his idea of good and evil off of God. And specifically off of God is love. And so he showed how if we really want to say God is love, we have to realize this means sort of like the love for an artist for his work of art. So the artist doesn't care whether the work of art is very comfortable, but it instead sort of demands its excellence. And so love has this sense of demanding the excellence out of the beloved. And so if we say love your enemies, well, that means you desire their excellence. It doesn't mean just you're going to go and give them a hug and forgive and forget. It's no, you desire their excellence, which means you're going to hate their evil, but you're going to love them. It's kind of hate the sin, love the sinner, that kind of idea. And then it makes sense that if we're thinking in this dimensions analogy, whoever exalts himself in two dimensions is going to certainly be humbled once he gets to three. But then it also makes sense that if you don't desire the excellence that God desires for you in sort of the third spiritual dimension, then there's no way that you're going to actually become what God wants you to become.
What are your plans after graduation?
We'll see. I don't know. I'm not sure yet. I've lots of options, so.
Oration Week at Wyoming Catholic College is an annual shot in the arm for our faculty and staff as we hear from young, well-formed thinkers. It's a reminder of why we're here, of why it matters, of why we think our little college is part of the hope for an increasingly degenerate and intellectually flabby culture. We are rightfully proud of our students. Who wouldn't be? From Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.